Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Gopi Jana Valabha Irivaradhari. Gopi Jana Valabha Irivaradhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Gopi Jana Valabha Girivaradhari. Gopi Jana Valabha Girivaradhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jaya Kishor Kishori, Jaya Kishor Kishori, Jaya Kishor Kishori, Jaya Kishor Kishori. Jaya Jaya Jagannath, Jaya Jaya Jagannath, Jaya Baladev, Jaya Jaya Subhadra. Nitai Gora Haribo, Haribo, Haribal, Nitai Gora Haribo. Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Jaya Prabhupada.
Vishnu Padaya Paramhamsa Parivya Gacharya Asatara Sada Shri Srimad His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Jayam Vishnu Padaya Paramhamsa Parivya Gacharya Asatara Sada Shri Srimad His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai Anantakadi Vaishnavrinda Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavatam Gantaraj Ki Jai All glories to the assembly of devotees All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Today's reading is from Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 10 Chapter 10, Text 4, chapter entitled Deliverance of the Yama Larjuna Trees. Anta Pravisha Gangayam Ambojavana Rajini Chikirdatur Yuvatibir Gaja Viva Kanubihi Antapravishya Gangayam Ambojavana Rajini Chikri Datur Yuvatibir Gajaviva Karanubihi. One more time. Antak Pravisha Gangayam Ambojavana Rajini Chikridatur Yuvatibir Gajaviva Kanubihi. Antapravishya Gangayam Ambojavana Rajini Chikridatur Yuvadibir Gajaviva Karnubihi. Antapravishya Gangayam Ambojavana Rajini Chidratur Yuvatibir Yajaiva Karnovihi. Thank you for chanting. We'll go to word by word translation. Antaha, within. Pravishya, entering. Gangayam, the Ganges known as Mandakini. Amboja, of lotus flowers. Vana Rajini, where there was a congested forest. Chikridatuhu, the two of them used to enjoy. Yuvatibihi, in the company of young girls. Gajau, two elephants. Eva, just like. Karanubihi, with female elephants. Translation: within the waters of the Mandakini Ganges, which were crowded with gardens of lotus flowers, the two sons of Kuvera would enjoy young girls, just like two male elephants enjoying in the water with female elephants. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. People generally go to the Ganges to be purified of the effects of sinful life. But here is an example of how foolish persons enter the Ganges to become involved in sinful life. It is not that everyone becomes purified by entering the Ganges. Everything, spiritual and material, depends on one's mental condition. Om Agyanati Mandasya Gyananjaya Shakala Chakshivim Tamgina Tashmahi Shukurayana Shri Chaitanya Anabhishtam Shthapinam Yana Putraya Swayama Bhagata. Thank you for letting me speak today. Thank you for coming. And we will discuss this nice verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 10, Deliverance of the Yamala Ranjuna Trees. So as you may know, the Yamala Ranjuna Trees, in their previous life, were two demigods, the sons of Kuvera, who were misbehaving and were luckily cursed by the sage Narada Muni, who is a pure devotee of Lord Krishna. So this is basically, the chapter describes once there were trees and they were in the courtyard of of Nanda Maharaj, and then the rest of the chapter will reveal the story. What I would like to focus on today is that why were the two sons of Kuvera cursed? Well, first of all, they were not well behaved, and not only that, but they committed like three levels of sin. First of all, they did something that was improper, sinful, and then not only that, but they also were in the holy place and did that sinful activity. And also, when a saintly person came around, they did not show him respect, or they didn't feel any shame or remorse for committing that sinful activity. So you can observe here, notice here, three levels of sinful transgression. To me, it shows the tendency of our society, which is to give in to lust and to disrespect one's teachers and superiors. This is a tendency, unfortunate tendency, in this age of Kali Yuga especially. People easily give in to lust, and there is no respect for teachers or superiors. Whether you are a human being or a demigod, it doesn't matter. There is always this tendency, and we have to be very careful not to give in to the tendency. Krishna, Arjuna asks this interesting question. He realizes this tendency of human beings. He asks Krishna a nice question in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita, verses 36 to 38. He says, I'll just say the English, by what is one impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly? And Krishna replies that it is lust only that is transformed into wrath, and which is the greatest sinful enemy of this world. The particular word Krishna uses, verse 36. It's a nice word. Krishna says, the greatest enemy. The word Vairinam is the greatest enemy. So if you take care of that enemy, everything will be kind of smooth. But until that time, the lust that transforms into wrath, frustration and wrath, is the greatest enemy of human beings and or anyone whose goal is to become a spiritually oriented person. And not only that, but Krishna continues on to explain that there are different degrees of this lust. That's verse 37. Srila Prabhupada mentions in the purport to that verse that lust needs to be transformed into love. So there is no question of eliminating or killing lust. It's a question of transformation. And this statement of Srila Prabhupada proved to be a very revolutionary statement to me in terms of my previous thinking. My previous thinking was that to become spiritual, you have to repress all the bad tendencies. But here, it was quite revolutionary to me in terms of my previous thinking. And so in today's lecture, I would like to focus on the method that Krishna consciousness, how Krishna consciousness uses, Krishna consciousness movement uses to achieve purification for the sake of God's service in this world. So what is that method that our Krishna consciousness movement uses, and how does it work, and how could it appeal to others who are not officially devotees? So I'd like to explore that in today's lecture. Hopefully we have enough time. So first of all, like I said previously, I used to think that, you know, if you repress the bad inclination and try to follow good inclinations of then you make progress. However, I didn't have any clear direction from exploring different scriptures, any clear direction on what exactly good is. I mean, what does it mean to do good to others? Go to church, go to temple, and different people may define good in different terms. So if you do good and try not to do the bad things, I mean, different people can do different good things. And some of them may look like, oh, these good things are not actually so good, in my opinion. So who determines what is good, and how is it going to eliminate the bad inclinations in the heart? When I met my Guru Maharaj, at the beginning of my Krishna consciousness, the interesting thing he said that surprised me, he says, Bhakta Arak, do not abruptly stop anything you're doing unless it is like outright wrong, like, you know, you work at a slaughterhouse or you know, this kind of occupation. You don't need to stop your going to school. You don't need to stop your material education or you know, your material profession. And you don't need to stop exercising or doing martial arts. That is not necessary. Just add chanting Hare Krishna to your activities. So I was surprised. I was under the, my understanding previously was that to be spiritual, you have to abstain from all kinds of non-violent behavior, including martial arts. So for me, renouncing exercise and specifically martial arts was very hard, and I could not do it. So this was a dilemma for me, because I also at the same time wished to become a more spiritually minded person for the Lord's sake. So when my Guru Maharaj explained to me that in principle, Krishna consciousness does not directly oppose the four natural tendencies of human beings and animals. We have the four tendencies of sleeping, mating, defending, and was it sleeping, mating, defending, right? There's eating, right? Can't forget about that one. So we have those four activities that animals and human beings do, and Krishna consciousness does not, in principle, oppose them. But the word uses it dovetails those activities into Krishna consciousness. It's called technically Yukta Vairagya, or practical renunciation. And Prabhupada made some very important, profound statements to me about our movement. He said, I think among many precious things, they're like gems. He said that books are the basis. Books are the basis, and purity is the force, preaching is the essence, and utility is the principle. So the Yukta Vairagya concept of practical renunciation falls under the utility principle. So we dovetailing the material propensities for a higher purpose. So let's take, for example, the four activities that all human beings do, whether devotees or non-devotees, you know. We have the eating, so we're not repressing the eating, the urge to eat. We actually have very sumptuous prasadam. Right after this lecture, you can actually have some prasadam if you would like. And so we just make an adjustment. We keep our cooking and preparation clean. We offer the foodstuffs to Krishna, God, and we still eat and enjoy. Let Krishna enjoy first. And then the mating, devotees of Krishna, if they want to, they can get married, and, you know, sexual transactions are allowed under the vow of marriage for the purpose of procreation and raising Krishna conscious children. So that is not denied either. It just has to be adjusted and doing it for the sake of the Lord. Then you have gambling. Gambling normally involves going to a casino, you know, or investing in, I guess, in stocks, stock market. I've never done that before, but supposed to be, you know, one of the things that consider as gambling. You know, devotees of Krishna, they can take calculated risks for Krishna and start a business enterprise, and you know, with the goal to expand the preaching. So there's some risk, you know, there's some capital that's required, some volunteers, a workforce, whatever it takes, and devotees, many devotees start different projects, like our temple is starting a nice project, the Bhakti Loft, and we plan on inviting more people from outside into the Vedic culture, and that's certainly a risky project, but it's an adventure. We're doing it for Krishna, we are assured of Krishna's blessings. So in this way we can maybe gamble and have some adventure, and it's kind of it feels good. And then what is there? Eating, mating, defending according to the reason and capabilities Krishna gave us, we can defend, we should defend, we will defend our families, our devotees within our means to the best of our ability. That is understood. So these four activities of animals and human beings are not denied in our movement. We're not repressing anything. We are simply adjusting, redirecting, dovetailing those activities into Krishna consciousness, into God consciousness. We are doing those activities for God to make Him happy. And then as a byproduct, we also become happy. That's the science of it. Krishna tells Arjuna in chapter 2, verse 59, to confirm that, what I was saying, that the spirit soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, although the taste for sense objects remains. But by experiencing a higher taste, one is fixed in God consciousness. So here, the idea is that if you just simply stop the activities, shut down the activities of the senses, you may be okay for a while. Just like you have to hold your breath, you can hold your breath fine. You can hold it for 1 minute. Maybe you can hold it for 2 minutes or more if you're a great yogi. But eventually you have to take a deep breath and you have to make up for the deficit. So repression of our natural tendencies as human beings works in this way. We are bound to fail sooner or later. But Krishna explains in chapter 2, verse 59, the second part, that if you experience a higher taste, you'll be taking a spiritual breath which will rejuvenate you, and you will not be so thirsty on the external side of it. You'll be able to manage, adjust, and control nicely the material tendencies that are there in the mind and the senses. And Krishna also confirms that even if you're a man of knowledge, in chapter 3, entitled Karma Yoga, verse 33, even a man of knowledge works according to his own nature. Oh, what can repression accomplish? And in the beginning of the chapter, verse 5, he says that everyone is forced to act according to the qualities he has acquired from the three modes of material nature, which we will not go into it today, the three modes of nature and different mentalities. But we are all forced to act helplessly, Krishna says, according to the qualities from the three modes. No one can refrain from doing something, even for a moment. So if you force and try not to do certain things, you most likely fail. It will force us, the energy will force itself back on us, and we will not be able to control those urges. I take myself as an example. Before I learned from my Guru Maharaj about Krishna consciousness, I tried my best to many ways to curb the senses, but I failed numerous times. With Krishna consciousness, you find your mind at a higher level, so it's much easier. And one thing, some of you may relate to it, maybe you can even present it to others who are not devotees. I can understand the example, the principle of Yukta Vairagya. I can understand the principle better when I look at martial arts, however weird it sounds. But for me, if I look at certain things in terms of martial arts, it helps me understand. So maybe it may be useful for you to present it to others like this, who are into recreational activities. I was taught in martial arts, which I practice karate, the way of empty hand, that to overcome your opponent, the opponent will exert a certain amount of force on you, and you have to exert the same amount of force on the opponent, or greater force, in order to conquer. So it's a direct head-on opposition of the opponent's energy. So this is the philosophy of karate. However, there's another type of martial arts called Aikido. It's called the gentle way, wherein the principle is that you don't need to directly oppose the opponent's energy that they are trying to use against you. All you need to do is intercept one of the limbs, either hand or foot, and by skillful maneuver, suddenly change the direction of your movement, so the opponent's energy that the opponent generated against you will be used against that opponent to throw him on the ground. The principle of Aikido, the gentle way. So the kinetic energy is used by turning around, sudden change of movement. So by skillful maneuvering, we are using our energy efficiently. We're not wasting energy, and the opponent's getting tired is the key. The opponent is using all his energy, and you're just using that energy to control the opponent. So I can understand the principle of Yukta Vairagya, that I'm not directly opposing the urges of my senses to engage in different activities. I'm just slightly adjusting them, polishing them, and still doing the same thing, but in a very civilized and nice manner, and then do it for Krishna. And then the mind is happy, and the senses are happy. And another point that I wanted to stress is that you perform these activities concurrently with the activities of Bhakti Yoga, which is the pure activities of the recommended for this age, chanting and dancing, remembering Krishna. So this is one way to understand the principle of Yukta Vairagya, that our practical renunciation, that our Krishna consciousness movement uses to become purified, so the members become purified and serve God nicely. So you can understand that the principle of Yukta Vairagya is neither to negate activities, stop activities, or engage into activities, just to adjust according to our capacity. So my Guru Maharaj told me to continue on with my activities, just adjust them slightly. So for example, in practical terms, what I did to martial arts, instead of engaging full-time in karate, I became a personal trainer, and I still am able to teach some kickboxing, some movements, and without the necessity to compete or do too much. I focus on helping others achieve a good body and mind and spirit. So in this way, I'm still able to practice at a lower level, less on the performance side, more on the goodness side, where I can help others find their way to health and fitness, and hopefully bring them even closer to Krishna. So focusing more on the goals of Yukta Vairagya, the goals of Yukta Vairagya approach are both direct and indirect. Obviously, the indirect goal of practicing the Yukta Vairagya practical renunciation approach is to free ourselves from material attachments less painfully and gradually. Like I mentioned earlier, by concurrently performing Bhakti Yoga activities. And then the direct goal of Yukta Vairagya or renunciation is to achieve a state of consciousness where everything that you use is seen as Krishna's property. Everything within your field of action, within your field of vision, is seen as Krishna's property. Srila Prabhupada mentioned, I really like that example, he mentioned that that Lord Chaitanya does not recommend this monkey renunciation or Markanda Vairagya, where you externally renounce, you sit under the tree or in your cave, but your mind is still dwelling on the activities that you gave up. So he didn't approve of that. Lord Chaitanya did not approve of that, nor did Krishna in his teachings of Bhagavad Gita. Srila Prabhupada said, since everything belongs to Krishna, what is the question of renunciation? It already belongs to Krishna. He created everything. He gave us everything. So why would you renounce anything? Another nice example that I like to use is that I read somewhere in the scriptures, is that everything has its utility. For example, Srila Prabhupada would give this example of a knife. You know, devotees cut vegetables nicely for Krishna and prepare a sumptuous feast. Nice sabji, nice stew. But the knife in and of itself is not bad, but you can also use that knife to hurt someone, you know, really bad. So the activity itself is not bad, or the object itself. It's just a matter of consciousness, like Srila Prabhupada mentions in the purport to this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. See, everything spiritual material depends on one's mental condition. So in reality, that knife becomes spiritualized when used in Krishna's service. So where's the question of renunciation? Krishna confirms in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 6, entitled Astanga Yoga, or Dhyana Yoga, Astanga Yoga, that verse 29 to 30, that a yogi observes me in all beings and sees every being in me. And for one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I am never lost, nor is he ever lost to me. Very reassuring statement by Krishna. Just see everything in terms of Krishna's. Krishna owns it, and you're just trying to see how you can use it to the best of your ability so Krishna is happy. So this way, we offer more and more intention. We offer more and more intention within to work for Krishna. We offer the result of our work to Krishna and the intention to work, you know. Then we become more aware of God 24 hours a day. And I think I remember it was a nice... I remember one Christian friend told me once, and I remember that he told me many years ago, we invite the Lord into all of our activities, not just the few activities, but we invite the Lord into all of the activities. So I really like that statement too. We just invite the Lord into all of our activities. Not only we do not constrict our God consciousness to our attendance at the temple or morning prayer. We try to our best to intentionally work for Krishna and use everything in God's service. And we invite Lord Krishna into all of our activities. Then we follow the principle of always remembering Krishna and never forgetting Him, which Srila Prabhupada was very fond of. Srila Prabhupada really stressed it. Just remember Krishna, never forget Him. That's the purpose of chanting and doing all your activities for Krishna. So these are some of the indirect and direct goals of working in according to the Yukta Vairagya principle. And but even before reaching that state of pure consciousness, of complete purification, there are many advantages of using the Yukta Vairagya approach. And the first advantage is that nothing is wasted. Within one's fields of action, devotees are very resourceful and not wasteful. They always take care of every little thing for Krishna. I like also the example of our grandfather Acharya, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami, Srila Prabhupada's Guru Maharaj. He would use the newest technology available at the time to spread Krishna consciousness. He would use motorboats and printing press and utilize that. It was unheard of at those times, the beginning of the 20th century, to utilize these in the preaching activities. But yeah, he used motorboats, he traveled across the Ganges here and there, and instructed his disciples to share the good news, chant the holy name. So nothing is wasted. Technology is not wasted. Our propensities, qualities of character, we're all different. There's nothing is wasted. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is also our hero, someone to look up to as far as like a perfect example of Yukta Vairagya. And the second benefit of using the Yukta Vairagya approach, and even before we reach that state of purification from material desires, is that we get to preserve our strengths. And we are keeping our weaknesses at bay by properly engaging them at a minimal level. Like I was saying earlier, you know, we do not negate, you know, sexual transactions. Just as long as you're married and you have your goal is to create a Krishna conscious progeny. Nothing is neglected. We can work, function at that level as well. So we get to preserve our strengths and we keep our weaknesses at bay, whatever they are. We engage them naturally according to the Yukta Vairagya principle, the principle of Krishna consciousness. So this way those weaker tendencies do not disturb us in life. And we can focus on the spiritual activities. I like the example of one devotee gave me. I was in a dilemma years ago. I was not sure where I fit as far as the, I think I might have mentioned that 2 weeks ago, in the ashram system, the Vedic system. I wasn't sure if I should remain a brahmachari or a grihastha, and I asked one devotee who had a lot of experience, a very knowledgeable devotee, and then I asked him, I'm not sure which way to go. Looks like it's very hard for me to practice this way. I seem to be stuck at a certain level, and not sure what I can do at this point. So he gave me this nice example that Srila Prabhupada gave to his disciple who was struggling. And this disciple told Srila Prabhupada that, Srila Prabhupada, I'm sorry, but I'm failing at this level. I cannot follow the principles correctly. I think I should get married. I'm not able to maintain my brahmachari status or things like that. So the situation was something like that. And so Srila Prabhupada gave him this example of a lion and the natural elements that work for the lion, and a crocodile and natural elements that work for the crocodile to function. So he said that, do not worry, understand the example of this lion and how powerful the lion can be when he is on land and how weak he becomes when he is in the water and he has to fight. and understand the example of this crocodile who is strong in the water, he's at his best. But when the crocodile is on land, he's much weaker. He's much weaker. So this example gave me a very clear idea that that I should change something in my status, because I cannot conquer my weaknesses at that level, so I should move on and do adopt a different level of service to Krishna, and then I can be strong. I can emphasize my strengths, and I can control, ameliorate, improve my weaknesses. So this example was just like perfect for me to understand. And then I remember talking to this devotee, and I told him, oh, I can understand it better, because I remember from martial arts that, you know, you have this cage fighting, and you have different fighters, and if some fighters, they specialize in boxing, they try to maintain the stand-up position. But if a boxer gets on the ground and the wrestler gets him on the ground, the boxer is at a great disadvantage. And if you're a wrestler, you try to maintain, keep your fight to the ground, because if you stand up and start throwing punches and kicks, you're at a great disadvantage if you're fighting a boxer. So the idea is that the wrestler should try to preserve his environment and his groundwork, and the boxer or kickboxer should preserve the stand-up mid-range and high-range. So I could understand it easily, and so I made a decision to change my status. And then from that point on, everything was smoother. So I thank the devotee very much for helping me, you know, many years ago. I appreciate it. So that's number two of Yukta Vairagya. We get to preserve our strengths and use them in Krishna consciousness, and keep our weaknesses under decent control. It is also, you know, we're assured of Krishna's help, because ultimately, when you read Bhagavad Gita, Krishna clearly explains to Arjuna that this is recommended by him, this approach of working in devotion, working in the mood of Karma Yoga and the mood of Yukta Vairagya, doing activities for Krishna. This is recommended in favor of just plain, just giving up activities and making your mind very unhappy and restless. So Krishna recommends that approach, and we guarantee that we are assured of his help. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5, verse 2, that says, Supreme Personality of Godhead replied, when Arjuna asked what is better, Arjuna said, you know, you ask me, you tell me that this is good too, and this is good, but Krishna said, no, these approaches of renunciation and giving up the activities and working in the spirit of renunciation are both good. However, of the two, working for me in devotion and offering me something from your work is better, especially in this age of Kali Yuga, where it is very hard to just shut down material activities. So Krishna recommends that Arjuna adopts this way of working for him. Working for Arjuna meant fighting on the battlefield and not going away to a cave and meditating on Krishna. But he was capable of doing that. But the principle of utility and Krishna's desire was that, yes, he should be fighting. Krishna has some mission to accomplish, and Arjuna was the one of the main main heroes in that situation, in that plan, Krishna's plan. So based on that principle of utility and Krishna's mission, Arjuna was supposed to fight and conquer for Krishna instead of going to a cave and meditating on him. So Krishna tells us in chapter 9, verse 22, that when you use this method of working for me, I will carry to you what you lack, and I will preserve what you have. So, like I said earlier, the strengths will be amplified, and our weaknesses will be fortified. So we keep going nicely in our service to Krishna, and we get purified eventually. So we we eventually engage only in the very spiritual activities of chanting and dancing, with nothing, with no desires left other than that, and of course sharing this great fortune with others. I don't know what time it is, but I think the conclusion is coming. In conclusion, I would like to say that this scientific approach of Yukta Vairagya that our Krishna consciousness movement uses is a very scientific, you know, what Srila Prabhupada has built for us. He built like a very scientific house in which the whole world can live. And because it's very scientific, it's a science of the mind and spirit and body, we can accommodate all levels of human beings at different immature or mature stages of service to God. And even if they have a seed, some slight desire to serve God and do something for God, we can accept them and engage them properly according to the principle of Krishna consciousness, of Karma Yoga, Yukta Vairagya. We can engage them practically, so eventually, maybe not today, but in a month, in a year, from the seed of that desire to serve God, the fruit will come. And this is the scientific approach that Srila Prabhupada gave us, how we should work for Krishna. And when you use the right method of growing that seed, nourishing that seed, the fruit will come certainly, the fruit of love of God. Thank you very much for your attention, and I will be happy to answer any questions. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
I appreciated very much the analogy that you made of Yukta Vairagya with the gentle approach to martial arts. Mm-hmm. One thing that I thought was that in martial arts, you explain the philosophy is very clear. You have to defeat your opponent. Yeah. Or you have to, you know, yeah, it's about defeating your opponent. So the gentle method still is for the purpose of defeating the opponent. So you make the comparison that similarly, with Yukta Vairagya, the purpose is to defeat the tendency that is there of the false ego to claim, you know, all these fruits for one's enjoyment. So that's a part that we have to have very clear. Sometimes as beginners or neophyte devotees, and we're engaging by the guidance of the spiritual master in Yukta Vairagya, or at least we're engaging in devotional service, and we still maintain our material activities, but we have to be clear that we have to have the purpose of engaging those things in order to defeat the attachments and the whole material mentality that we have, the sense gratification, enjoyment. So I like the analogy very much because it makes the perspective of you actually fighting, and fight you have to try to win it. You know, you don't fight for losing.
Right.
So there is an opponent and you have to defeat. So you use this technique, as you say. You know, it's great. You don't spend unnecessary energy, and you use that energy to actually knock down the opponent.
Right.
And you know, you have the principle of being in the fighting with your strength in mind for the purpose of defeating your opponent. So that the defeating the opponent is the goal.
Right.
So thank you. I liked it very much, that analogy.
Thank you, Prabhu. I'm glad you like it. Yeah, it's I can understand it myself, so I can share with others if I understand myself. But it's nice to share with others. Maybe this example may speak to others, like who are into exercise, and they may be attracted to Krishna consciousness if they understand this example. Maybe. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Yes. I don't want to sound like you too loud. As far as gambling goes, that's discouraged. So I'm thinking that dealing with the stock market is also gambling. So I thought that was discouraged.
Yes.
So is that your understanding, that we should invest in the stock market, or
no?
How about Subal? Did you have an understanding on that? Yeah. So, but people do that in this kind of. That just came to my mind, you know, gambling in that respect. Did you want to say? Pardon me? I can't hear you. Sorry.
If one were to invest in the stock market, then it would have to be secure bonds, such as government bonds. So it's not, then it's not gambling, yes, but it would still be stock market.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for your class. You made a lot of wonderful points, and I'll try to connect some of them. Maybe we could expand on some of them. Subal mentioned about martial arts. So that, I think I brought this quote up to you that I really appreciated many years ago. I brought it up to you, you know, when you first gave class, one of the first times. To some extent, the quote essentially says, martial arts isn't about getting a black belt, it's about being one. Be courteous, show respect, inspire. And actually Shankar Pandit Prabhu, he was actually kind of mentioning a similar pastime last night. I kind of asked him about this, related to this point actually. There's one demon named Banasura. There's another demon named Bomasura, but this one is B-A-N-A.
Mm-hmm.
S-U-R-A, Banasura. I don't know too much about the pastime, but I need to read up on it now. We were just discussing it last night, and
mm-hmm.
he was essentially saying, and from what I remember, Banasura was a worship of Lord Shiva, and he acquired many arms.
Ooh.
And he defeated all his opponents, every opponent he defeated. But then he got so bored, he was like, nobody can challenge me. So he thought the purpose of getting a black belt was to defeat his external enemies, but the purpose of any martial arts, spiritual martial arts, to defeat your internal enemies. Then Lord Shiva, I believe, said, no, you're gonna find your match, you know, I think Krishna, you know, you're gonna find your match.
Found his match.
Krishna, yeah, Krishna kicked his butt, so he found his match. So anyway, that was just a side point, and I need those notes. Thank you. You were mentioning, and I'll try to expand on some of these points, and maybe you could also, I think you were mentioning that our opulences are like a knife, something to the extent they're neither good nor bad. It depends on how you use them. Correct me if I'm wrong, is that true? And we see that in the material world all the time, and Krishna's opulences are number and sense, beauty, riches, fame, etc. And these opulences can be used for either good or evil. But one particular opulence we don't think is an opulence is that either hurt others or harm others, or hurt us and harm us, is renunciation. Renunciation is also an opulence. And one quote that I really appreciate about Raghunath Maharaj, he says, you were mentioning also that we don't own any of these particular opulences. Everything's the property of Krishna. And you were mentioning something that I've mentioned before, and it reminds me this particular part, he was essentially saying in one lecture that Srila Prabhupada was once asked by a devotee for permission to renounce everything. Srila Prabhupada's response was, Krishna owns everything, so what do you have to renounce? The only thing you have to renounce is the misconception that you have something to renounce. So we're not the possessors of, we're not the owners of wealth. We're the recipients of wealth. Our net worth is our allowance. Like you give your kids maybe some allowance, but you can also take it away. And also opulence that's given to us and can be taken away from us is renunciation. And so there's a pastime like that. I'll mention a couple of pastimes. Where one pastime in a Krishna book, chapter 17 of Krishna book, it's also mentioned in another chapter, but in chapter 17, it's described that Sobari Muni was very proud of his renunciation. Instead of using his renunciation to be humble, he used it as a platform to consider himself an authority to criticize others. So Sobari Muni came into the Jamuna River where he was meditating for thousands of years. And Garuda ate some fish. And so he criticized Garuda, if you eat these fish again, I'll kill you. And because of this aparad, the Lord took away his renunciation. He thought he was the owner of renunciation, but the Lord took it away. So when he saw two fish mating, he became lusty, married 50 girls. You know, he was humble, etc. It's a long story, but it ended in a good pastime. But so Prabhupada mentions in chapter 17, verse 15 of his in the Gita, in its purport, chapter 17, verse 15. The purport of that talks about austerity of speech, which Sobari Muni didn't have. It says that one should not try to correct somebody or criticize them if that person hasn't accepted you as their guru, their mentor, their teacher. Mm-hmm. And we see that Sobari Muni tried to correct Garuda, even though Garuda already had a teacher, Lord Vishnu.
Okay, yeah.
However, on the flip side of the coin, in the beginning of this chapter, Narada Muni did the exact same thing. He instructed somebody who didn't accept him as their guru. In the beginning of this chapter, it says that why did he want to get revenge against Nala Kuvada and Manigriva? Why did he instruct them? Like, Narada Muni was also a renunciate. And he went up to Nala Kuvada and Manigriva, and he says, basically, you guys are a rascal. I'm going to curse you to become trees. They didn't ask for his advice. They didn't ask to be his guru. He automatically, but why did Narada Muni, why did Sobari Muni get a reaction, and how come Narada Muni didn't? Well, one thing that came to mind is that maybe you could explain, is dependent on our consciousness. You know, Sobari Muni used his renunciation as a platform of egotism, how to push others down. And Narada Muni used his platform of renunciation as a means to help others. Sometimes people are in such a helpless position that they're not able to call 911. So the paramedics come. And so he saw that Nala Kuvana and Manigriva, they were too helpless to call 911. You know, to ask for a teacher, ask for a guru, ask for a paramedic. They're suffering so much. So he voluntarily made it. So that's what I realized, is that really how we instruct people depends on our mentality. So my question is that how does one distinguish, because we see all the time people all the time instructing, criticizing people who have not accepted them as his teacher. And sometimes people benefit from that, and sometimes people don't. Sometimes we fall down for criticizing, lose our Christian conscience. Sometimes we don't. So how is this a person supposed to make the proper decision in such circumstances?
Well, that's a very good question, Prabhu. Wow.
How do I know my decision is not based on my egotism, or how does it know it's based on sincerely caring about this person's well-being, essentially?
Well, thank you for all these nice points. Certainly not easy to decide. I mean, it depends if the situation is like more of an emergency situation, that someone is like a life and death situation, or is it just this person is doing well, they're just a little bit off here. So is this necessary to give him advice? Oh, you should be following this rule. You're chanting, but you're not doing this. Maybe it's not necessary at this point. But if it's a life and death situation, like, oh, I'm doing very bad, you know, I'm thinking about suicide, you know, and all this, then by all means, call a devotee who, you know, or help them out somehow immediately, you know. I mean, it depends on the situation, and if the situation is so urgent, emergency, you have to act. But if it's not that kind of situation, then simply listen. If you care for that person, really care, then the strategy will come to you. If you care for another devotee, it will come from within. And you can, if there's time, you can call other senior devotees to, you know, anonymously maybe, hey, you know, I've got this situation, I got this friend, you know, what kind of advice would you give him, you know, without mentioning names? Maybe it's not necessary. And then if you have time, then go like that. If you're not sure what, if you should say anything or correct someone. I don't know. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Oh. I think Subhat Prabhu has some comment.
I was going to say that there is a difference between Savari Muni and Narada Muni. And it highlights also the aspect of etiquette and common sense. In the case of Savari Muni, criticizing and offending, criticizing that became an offense, and he paid a reaction for that, is that Garuda was a superior. So, Savari Muni, although don't even considering that Garuda is an eternal associate of the Lord, there is a pure devotee who is the carrier of Lord Vishnu, and there he is, you know, he's a yogi, so he have the audacity to actually criticize and curse Garuda. So that was a terrible offense. In the case of Narada Muni, he is a pure devotee, an associate of the Lord, is actually a Shakti Vesh avatar of the Lord. And then there is the two sons of Kuvera, who were just demigods who were overwhelmed by their opulence, and you know, and so the correction is appropriate and the curse is appropriate because it is based on the well-wishing knowledge, and the result of that curse is beneficial. The result of the curse of Savari Muni was a complete disaster. It was a disaster for him, and he also created a very difficult situation that at the end Krishna's pastime, but that's how Kaliya ended in Vrindavan, you know, causing all that kinds of disturbance to the inhabitants of Vrindavan. So we have to have the common sense also in terms of trying to correct someone or criticize someone. I mean, in general, we have to be very careful about it. But etiquette has to be there. We should not correct or criticize someone who is our superior. And to those who are our equals, we can sort of, depending on the relationship, and for those who are our juniors, also depends on the relationship, but we can actually correct, you know, but it's also depending on the relationship. But there's etiquette included there too.
Thank you, Subhat Prabhu. Thank you. Okay, no more questions? Any more questions? Thank you very much for your attention. Manchaka Patravyas Chakri Pasindavasavich. Patidam Pavanevi Vaishnavi Namanamana.